Discover the future of technology at workshopsfest.dev 2023, hybrid edition, featuring both in-person and online sessions led by industry experts. Master modern full-stack development with Angular, Next, React, Quick, TypeScript, NgRx, performance, reactivity, and cutting-edge technologies. Don't miss out. Register now for this groundbreaking event and elevate your expertise. Workshopfest.dev.
What's up, everyone? This is Dariusz Kalwarczyk, co-founder of MG Poland, JS Poland, Quick Poland, and WorkshopFest.dev. Welcome back to the JavaScript Master Podcast. Today, we've got a special guest from Cologne, Germany. Engineer and e-pilot, speaker, author, Google developer expert, Microsoft MVP. Ladies and gentlemen, Michu Goel. Hi, Michu. How are you?
Hey, doing good. Thanks for asking. What about you?
Yeah, I'm great. Thank you. Could you walk us through your journey into coding, particularly your deep dive into JavaScript?
Sure. That's going to take me back, you know, to when I started engineering. So I remember I had this young older brother who was into engineering, and I always used to think that this is quite interesting and I might want to try that. So I did bachelor's in engineering as my studies as well. Yeah, I think that's where the journey began, really, into coding. We studied Java and C++, you know, all those languages, never really JavaScript. They don't teach back in school, they don't teach JavaScript. But then I think that's where the journey began. And after the university, it was people around. I used to participate in competitions like Microsoft Imagine Cup, where I used to meet a lot of people, you know, who would be into the community or would be into JavaScript. And yeah, that's where it all began.
And it looks like you like it.
Oh, I love it. I mean, there's bad days when, you know, you beat your screen because you cannot solve a bug. But then the next day you wake up and 5 minutes, the bug is solved. And it sounds, I mean, everything sounds good, perfect, happy.
Let's talk about your role as a software engineer at ePilot. What kind of projects are you working on?
So I started working as a software engineer at ePilot. And the idea, the thing, the product that we're working on is... So we are building an app that allows, you know, players in the energy industry of Germany to sell their complex products. Like when I say complex products, it's things like, you know, solar panels or heat pumps and, you know, things like these, which cannot be sold on Amazon, for example. So we make it easier for them to, you know, sell these things on from the app, just like you sell shoes on Zalando, for example. So yeah, that's the product we are building, and the tech stack is great. I love how, you know, we try to adopt new things and work with those to still solve user pains, and, you know, especially the users who come from the world of SAP, for example, or, you know, even Excel. They were using Excel before. So yeah, it's fun to bring them onto an application which uses new technologies, which, you know, where engineers also focus on making the application performant, you know, not just delivering something, but delivering it with quality. I think that's really important, especially for people in the energy industry who are, you know, who don't care much about the software. I mean, it's a strong statement to say that they don't care about software, but you know what I mean. When you're an engineer, when you're into the computer industry, you know that you like things faster, but not everywhere else. So yeah, that's kind of the thing that I'm working on. Most of my focus is on the front end side of the application, and also now to, you know, make our application more performant, because the more we are scaling, we see performance challenges, and, you know, that's where performance also comes into picture, which I love, because, you know, it's not just a side thing that I'm trying to focus on performance, but also at work. And that's where the real challenge begins.
Let me ask you a little differently. Sprechen Sie Deutsch?
Ein bisschen.
Ein bisschen, okay. It's a good start. What were some of the most complex challenges you encountered while working with JavaScript and Angular? And how did you tackle them?
That's a good question to, you know, think on. I think the biggest challenge when you're working not just with JavaScript or Angular, but with any language is, you know, to approach the language to write code in a way that it's not smart code. It's not, I mean, it should be smart code, but it shouldn't be clever code, you know, where it makes total sense to you, but when someone else tries to read your code, it's too clever for them to understand even. And I think this was something that I learned recently, because even myself as an engineer, I would try to, you know, make the code the smallest possible, and then it might not make sense to the other engineers. And I think that's one thing that you have to really ensure with any language. But if I think of a complex challenge with JavaScript, or, you know, the frameworks that I'm working with lately, it's when the project grows, you know, it's when the framework-based project grows, and half of the things then depend on the framework that you chose, first of all, and then also on the way you use the framework. These days with React, Angular, and Svelte, or any other frameworks, you have so much liberty to write code the way you wish to, that you end up in mud, you know, at a later point in state, and you have to really see how the usage could be better, how, you know, it only solves your pain, the thing that you're trying to solve, but also doesn't land you in, you know, in a lot of code issue or a lot of performance issues, especially with so many DOM nodes that we add in the browser with these frameworks, because there's a lot of boilerplate code that comes along with. You know, it's not those days when there was just vanilla JavaScript that you used to write just to solve your pain, and no other, you know, bundles that would come with other third-party libraries that you're using. So with all of those things included, things do get complicated at a point. And the recent challenge that I saw was exactly this. It was exactly how we would write React at work. We are in a micro front-end architecture, and we have multiple frameworks that we use to write parts of our application. And so there was one framework that we are using, and, you know, it would take crazy rendering time, and we have to really focus on, you know, each line of code and calculate how much performance issue it could be creating. You know, one line of code, if it seems like a performance candidate, we would rethink it and reconsider, and, you know, choose a better alternative maybe. There's also this library that I use. I think many engineers use it. It's called import cost something. It's called import cost, I think. And then it calculates the size of your bundles. And, you know, in the IDE, if, for example, you're using VS Code, it would just tell you that, okay, this library that we just added, it takes this much size. Are you sure you want to add it, or maybe choose an alternative, which is like a smaller size? So, yeah, things like this.
How did you achieve the impressive titles of Google Developer Expert for Web Technologies and Angular and Microsoft MVP?
Impressive titles. I like the adjective that you used there. So, yeah, I mean, if I think about it, it was not really focused on, you know, trying to achieve these titles. But I remember I was writing blog posts because, you know, DJ, right? Dhananjay Kumar, who's the organizer of NG India, he used to write a lot of blog posts, and he has crazy number of blog posts on his blog. And I think everything that he was learning, he would write it down. And I really liked the way he was doing it, because even if you don't know things, you write it for yourself. And when I began, you know, learning new things, for example, when I began learning Angular, that's what I started doing. I started writing any new concept I was learning. I started writing about routing, for example, you know, how route guards work, because I was new to those concepts. And then, yeah, I just kept on writing. And I think that's when, you know, it also started helping other people. I didn't start with, you know, with the thought that, okay, my blog should help others, because I was writing very naively. I don't even like those blog posts now, because it's written very much as a beginner, because I was just learning, you know. And you know how after a point we start hating the things that we wrote in the beginning, but I don't want to delete them. But yeah, my point is, I kept on writing, and then people used to come to me and actually like comment on the blog posts and say that, you know, this is really helpful. I actually could fix a problem because of this thing, this code, piece of code that you put there. And yeah, I think that's when it becomes more of giving, you know, also as an engineer. Yeah, and that's when I think I was nominated for the Google Developer Expert Award, and also actually also at the same time Microsoft MVP. These were very around the same time. And yeah, then there were a few, you know, there's this process that you follow to become a Google Developer Expert or Microsoft MVP. There's some technical things that you have to clear. For example, you know, to answer if you really understand the concept well. And then also the community side of things. We call it community, but it's more about how, you know, the things that you're doing are helping others, are helping yourself even. So that side of things as well are considered, or I can call it a criteria to become a Google Developer Expert. So yeah, if anyone, you know, is planning to go into that field, planning to become a Google Developer Expert maybe, then yeah, just keep contributing in a way that helps you, first of all, writing, learning, and you know, not just writing, but it could be open source if you like to do that. If you're not somebody who likes to write, write code, then yeah, just write, do open source. That's also, there's so many GDEs who are into, you know, just open source, and they help people via open source. So yeah, I think that's the way to go.
Well said. What are your go-to JavaScript tools, libraries, or frameworks that have significantly improved your developer workflow?
I think in this world, like these days, everyone is just going to say Copilot, ChatGPT, all of those things. But okay, I'll go back a little bit and, you know, also mention the tools that have actually really helped, and, you know, not just AI who's learning from us and then also telling us at the same time, teaching us at the same time. One tool I already mentioned, I guess, in the previous questions, which was import cost, which helps to calculate the size of bundles that you're adding. That's really helpful because you wouldn't have to come back later to your code to see that what's so big in my application that's making it load so slowly, for example. You know, you would know just the way compile time and runtime works. It's the same. You know about the size of your problems, of your bundles exactly when you're writing it, not, you know, after some time. So yeah, that's one. There's another extension called Peacock by John Papa. I'm not sure if you've used it before, but it changes the color of your IDEs. And especially now that I'm working with the micro front-end architecture, we have so many different code bases, and you would always end up confused that, okay, I was working here and, you know, end up confused. So I have all different IDEs. I mean, one IDE, all different windows, but with different colors. So it really helps. It's just the productivity, but yeah, really helps with that. And I recently came across this terminal. It's an AI based terminal called WARP, WARP, and it has so many interesting things. For example, integrated AI. So there's a command which lets you run it in AI mode, and that would mean, for example, at a point you forget, a command or something. You just tell the terminal that, okay, I want to do this. Can you help me with the command for that? And there you go. Everything in the terminal. You don't have to go Google it or ChatGPT. It's there in the terminal. And I really like that for things like, you know, when I have to cherry pick commands, or when I cherry pick commits, or when I have to, you know, do any standard, you know, commands, but that's not in your head because we always Google things, right? So for that, I really like that terminal. So that could be another thing that could help you. It's not for everybody, but yeah, whatever floats your boat.
Then let's talk about ChatGPT.
So the conversation finally goes to ChatGPT, because every conversation...
Everyone talks about ChatGPT, yeah. Yes.
Yeah. I think I'm counting days now where there's, at least there should be one day when there's no discussion about ChatGPT, but I'm failing at that. It doesn't really happen. It's so popular. But yeah, to your question, I like it for some things. I hate it when it doesn't help me and, you know, it behaves dumb in the end of the day because it doesn't have access to, you know, everything that we have. I like how it's helpful with the scenarios where you don't want to spend too much time Googling things, and, you know, it could give you straight out facts, or, you know, just help with 10 results from Google, which you'd have to navigate through, but it gives you all of those in one place. That way, great. With code, not so much. I was trying to fix a problem recently with Elasticsearch for, you know, the search that we are using in our platform. And it kept, pointing to the same wrong answer. And I was like, okay, this is wrong. Could you try to maybe improve it? And then the same answer, but then, it would apologize, then the same answer. So it has a long way to go for now, but it's doing good. It's progressing really fast. It can leave humans behind if you don't try to catch up with it. But yeah, it still has a long way to go, I think. But I love it. I do use it every day as a paired programmer for myself.
Please share your experience of authoring step-by-step guide Angular routing and a hands-on guide to Angular. What inspired you to write those books and what impact do you hope they'll have?
Wow, that was a long time ago that I wrote this book, Step-by-Step Guide Angular Routing. And I remember that I approached it as, because it was my first time writing a book, right? So it was as overwhelming as it sounds writing a book, because I was also new to this world of authoring books. But I remember I approached it as writing a blog post, because at that time I was writing blog posts, right? So each chapter, I would take it as one blog post that I had to write and maybe spend a week on it and, do the same for all the chapters. The book was about Angular routing. It was not a general, Angular book. So it was a niche topic about rider routing, route guards, and, how the priority should be, lazy loading routes, things like that, route resolvers, for example. So, it was fun. It was challenging at times. There would be times when I would think that, okay, maybe I should just not write and just scrap it. But then also another day, another blog post. And so I think breaking it down into those blog posts really helped. I didn't look at it as one book that I had to write. So it didn't feel like a mountain to climb, but more like, stepping stones, and was a bit easier. The other book that you asked me about, which was A Hands-On Guide to Angular, it was more like a code space. I wrote it on Educator, and it was like a cookbook where you had that integrated terminal to try out things with. This was definitely more fun to write because, you cannot express technical concepts always without having an integrated terminal where you can try out things. It's always better when you are trying by just like workshops, just like hands-on, sessions. So I see so many people try it out and so many, have different challenges of their own. Every machine has their own command-related code challenges. So I love how that appears. So I think the impact is great on this side because people are also trying it along with. About physical books, just like my first one, I'm not sure because, now in the world of ChatGPT again, for example, in the world of AI, people end up going there and, just using it as an AI pair programmer. I'm not sure how many of us engineers are still going to those physical books. Some people just love books. I mean, I got myself a book recently about 9-hour DV. But yeah, it depends. Each person, some people love books, so they'll still go to those books. But I think most are just navigating through different tabs in their browsers and, trying to figure out issues without going to books. So I'm not sure if I would anytime soon consider writing another book because I would first want to see the impact that they are creating. So I would wait. I would wait for ChatGPT getting better at things and seeing how people are, benefiting out of it.
You're listening, JavaScript Master Podcast. Listen, code, repeat. Everything you need to know to become an JavaScript super developer.
Nevertheless, I love paperback books.
Completely agree with that. I mean, I would still go to, go back to the books to read about them. But also for, there's one point in your career when you just end up at the documentation of whatever you're trying to solve. For things which are, directly code related and you want to fix it right away. But when you want to understand a technology from scratch, from, where it started, there has to be a book that you want to read end of the day.
With the increasing popularity of front-end frameworks, what's your take on of the future of JavaScript and its evolving cloud space?
Yeah, I mean, I think gone are the days when, we were thinking of which framework to choose. Should I go with Angular? Should I go with React? You might have heard that question a lot, right? especially with these two combinations. But yeah, I think not anymore are the days when I hear this question anymore, that, you know, should I move in this framework because this sounds more reliable, this sounds more for a, you know, bigger application, but this one does seems to have more flexibility. But now the new question that we get to hear is that, you know, which framework ends up in more issues later on, which, you know, which framework when it scales, when the application scales, it results in problems. And I think we are already evolving in terms of, you know, solving that problem, which is where we are focusing on how to use the framework the right way. Every framework is correct. Every framework is solving problems. But, you know, you as a developer, it depends on you to use it correctly. And I think we already have some people, you know, fighting the new challenge of making one framework smaller in itself, making the framework lighter in itself, making a framework not allowing the developer to do much of the job, but then just, you know, fixing it itself. For example, Quick, right? That's solving this problem itself. Hydration, lazy loading, all of those things, developer really shouldn't have to care about it, right? They're trying to solve an issue. They're trying to build products for energy markets, for example. But if they end up, you know, thinking about how to lazy load an image, how to, you know, which image to lazy load, which image to eager load, if they keep thinking about those things, I think the creativity does get lost in the process. So yeah, ultimately, I think it's us, the web people, who have to work on making the frameworks, you know, less lighter, and, you know, the web faster in general. So I think that's the new challenge. It's not anymore the frameworks. All frameworks are great. They're solving problems. But let's just make the web faster now, you know, in general. I'm not sure if that answers your question. But yeah, I'm a web person. I'm just trying to, you know, make it faster, easier for developers, whatever framework you use. I'm in a micro front end situation. So I would love to pick up any framework that helps. But is it really solving the bigger picture? Is it really solving the bigger pain, which is the web? Yeah.
In a word, you are a big fan of performance.
Yeah, I mean, now that I have more performance issues to solve, I'm becoming a fan because I have so many problems to tackle.
As a female developer in a male-dominated field, what has your experience been like? And how have you navigated through the challenges? Do you have any advice for other women aspiring to enter the tech industry?
I think it's the perfect question for me. You know, in my company, I'm the only woman engineer. There's I think 30 to 35 engineers in all, and there's one woman engineer, but everybody else, male engineer. And to be honest, at our workplace, it never feels like that. You know, I mean, it would be once when we were taking a picture of the team of engineers that I felt that, oh, I'm the only woman engineer. But at work, when we are working on things, I've not really felt that, okay, being an only, female engineer, my approach to things is different or things like that. But I know the bigger problem that you're talking about, that, you know, there's so less women in the industry. And I think the problem doesn't really start from here. It starts from much earlier when you're studying school altogether. So the problem has to be approached from, you know, much earlier. I remember when I was in engineering, the ratio was what, 70-30, right? So there's no women that study engineering. There's no women then that, you know, who enter. For example, from that 70-30 ratio, there were at least 10 women from one class that, you know, decided to go into engineering. Half of them end up, choosing other tracks. And then 5 women end up in engineering. And then maybe, you know, they cannot keep up because there's so many other things to handle as well at the same time. So, yeah, I mean, to navigate through it, I wouldn't say for me personally it has been difficult. I wouldn't say so. It could also be the community, you know, which really helps you put your point forward, share more. I think with me writing blog posts and writing, you know, just sharing with the community, if you get more voice like that, it gets better. You don't, you know, just think about, you don't just get burned out at the end of the day. You also feel like you're contributing, and that feeling gives you confidence, and that confidence helps you just work better. So yeah, I mean, I think all the fellow women who are still thinking and, you know, not getting into the tech industry, don't worry about it. Just get into the tech industry. And I mean, there's no one better than us women who love solving problems, right? And engineering at the end of the day is just about solving problems.
Continuing to talk about the community, how does the developer community play a role in your professional growth? Can you tell us more about your contribution to the community, like writing articles for unravelweb.dev and participating in the JavaScript Master podcast?
Yeah, I like the latter part of this question, participating in this podcast. So yeah, like I already mentioned, I think part of me is, you know, just the community that has helped me grow in my professional career, because you know how engineering is, right? You're always behind a screen, and it could always give you that imposter syndrome that, okay, whatever you're doing, maybe, you know, you'd better do just something else where you can create more impact. So that feeling is very difficult to avoid. And, you know, every person does get it. It's not just about women and engineers getting it. Every human being gets it, I think. Especially in a field like engineering, where, you know, you don't share much, you don't talk much, you just have to fight that one problem for the day that you're trying to fix. And if it gets fixed, you feel like, oh, you're the king of the world and you know everything, you're the most genius person ever. But if it doesn't, that results in a bad day, that results in frustration. But then if you have something where you're also, you know, contributing, where you're giving away, where, you know, you're able to help one person out of, you know, a blog post that you wrote about maybe, you know, a Stack Overflow question that you answered, that really gives you that confidence and, you know, just helps you trust. And I think that feeling is the best. And you won't get that at work every day, because you cannot solve everything in one day and, you know, always feel great and genius. So that feeling, combined with this feeling of also contributing, works out the best. I love this combination. I don't want to be completely a community person, because, you know, then I would miss solving those complex engineering problems. I also wouldn't want to leave community ever, because then I know I would get exhausted and burnt out and frustrated end of the day. And that is not a good feeling for anyone end of the day. So yeah, I think that would answer my question about how important community is. And, you know, even for engineers at work, in my workplace, for people who are not, you know, that much into community and who think that, okay, maybe I'm only the person who's good behind the desk, maybe, you know, I make them rethink and just ask them to maybe attend one conference, because, you know, even attending one conference really brings that impact and influence. And for example, NG India, there's so many people who were before the pandemic who attended the conference, and for 2 years they couldn't. And then when we did the conference after the pandemic, there were so many people who mentioned that, okay, these 2 years I really tried to focus on improving myself. And community is about improving yourself along with others, right? So yeah, I think the impact is really visible there, and that's what we miss in engineering sometimes, and the combination works out the best.
Can you share some insights or key takeaways from the various tech events you attended, such as DevFest, Firebase Summit, and NGJS Poland?
Yeah, so good. I mean, great follow-up question, because the general part of this was all I tried to already mention that, right? That all of these events really bring that confidence and really, you know, bring you up as a person. But then if I talk specifically, there was this series of DevFest that I recently attended. Actually, all of those. I mean, that's one of the reasons I felt exhausted towards the end of the year. That, okay, too many events for the year. But yeah, I think these DevFest that Google does are a great way to bring people together. And, you know, they are in small setups, small organizations of people and, you know, communities, but it works out the best. It doesn't always have to be a large conference, right, that does events for people. These small setups, I think, in fact, are much better for engineers who do not like to be always that vocal. And, you know, maybe personally you get their problems solved, you talk one-to-one or like a group of five people. So I like how these DevFests were organized, and, you know, it also helped me to talk to so many people and also everyone else. Firebase Summit was actually a good experience in New York. This was my first time attending the Firebase Summit. I liked how, you know, product focused it was, and anyone who's into Angular or Firebase could really relate. I love, there was this one session which was about, you know, integrating Angular with Firebase, and there were, you know, improvements on that product. So that was really fun. I also attended ngPoland, actually, yeah, with you, right? I was speaking at JavaScript Poland, and oh, that was such a different experience. I mean, I always used to see in videos the huge stage that you have there, but then when I saw it in real, and all the speakers that you also could, you know, bring in from different parts of the world, it was such an amazing collection. I remember there was, you know, one from AWS, a speaker from AWS. I could learn so much from that session. I always, like, you know, think back on that session specifically. There was another session which was from actually Ryan about SolidJS and even performance. So things like these, you know, it's not always about just giving as a speaker. It's also about learning from so many different sessions. I love the experience completely. And also then, you know, the casual connections that you make even after the conferences, you know, for example, talking to you, I could share so many things with you after having met you the first time in India and then here. So it's just fun. I love these type of events where, you know, you can give and you can learn and then also have a good time with the people in general.
Your blog post shows that you had a very active 2022. How do you plan to break the pattern and find a balance between different activities such as writing, reading, and creating value this year?
I already blamed kind of DevFest series for, you know, being so active last year. But actually just not just that, I also moved countries the last year, and that was one of the reasons it felt a lot. You know, there were so many things on the plate. I was adjusting in a new culture. I was learning, you know, different things. I was also speaking at so many DevFest events. I was also learning from so many great speakers at the same time. So the reason, yeah, I mean, one of the reasons, I also wrote about this in my, you know, end of the year blog post, that maybe I want to change it a little bit this year and break that pattern. So one thing that I'm learning and trying to do this year is to try to say no. You know, it's really difficult, but it's also really important for you as a person to, you know, to get rid of the noise and also just focus. So that's one thing that I'm trying to do. I'm trying to speak a bit less, you know, at events for this year, but also, like I mentioned, speaking is not the only way to contribute, right? I'm trying to write more this year. I'm trying to, you know, be into open source more this year. It's already April and there's not much progress, so I better get back to it. but yeah, that's the idea.
Now let's talk about your favorite topic, performance. What are the causes of slow responsiveness in web application?
I think I have a lot to say on that. I've been seeing a lot of slow responsiveness in my application myself. I think one of the most, you know, obvious things in applications that you would see for slow responsiveness is how the application is structured, first of all, right? There could be huge bundles that cause this. There could be, you know, long tasks in the browser that, you know, result in slower response to the user that cause frustration at the end of the day, that cause rage clicks, which, you know, make your users click so many times that really shows the frustration of a user. So one of the things that I observed recently in our application was, you know, when the content gets more and there's things like a React table, for example, that would cause slowness in an application. And if you don't virtualize it, maybe, or only load the content that, you know, you require at that time, and it has to be really user-focused, right? You have to think from user perspective that, okay, the user is only trying to focus on this particular part of the page right now. So maybe just load that. And anything else that the user might need a bit later, maybe load that, you know, in the idle time that you get, that the browser gets. So yeah, things like loading everything at once, not lazy loading things, are the reason of slow performance, slow responsiveness. There could be, you know, a lot of images that you load. There could be a lot of scripts that you're loading in the browser. Things like Material UI, for example, that adds, that appends all those style tags in the head of your, you know, the DOM. And then that ultimately makes the DOM just too slow. So yeah, I think all of these things should be reconsidered when writing, and then make them result in, if not, you know, 100% perfect scenario, because they cannot be 100% perfect scenario, but a better situation where there's less CSS, for example, in the head of your DOM, there's content that's lazily loaded and it's only loading when the browser has some idle time. There's not, you know, one method, for example, which takes forever for the to respond to the user, but, you know, give some feedback to the user and do the rest of the work that can be done in the background, so that the user is not, you know, sitting there waiting that, okay, I wait when the response comes and then, you know, interact with the rest of the application, because that's when the frustration can go up high.
What is the rail guideline for response time on user input?
So yeah, this is actually one of the performance models that help, that gives you a structure actually to think about performance. I mean, right now, if I am starting newly into performance, how would I think about it? I would just look at the slowness of my application, right? I would just look at the buttons, for example, that are not responding on time and making me wait. But so Rail is actually a performance model, which is giving you this one structure, and I'll tell you what it stands for. But yeah, it makes you think about performance from the user's perspective. And that's the idea about thinking about performance, right? So it says R-A-I-L. R stands for response, A stands for animation, and I stands for the idle time of the browser, and then L finally stands for loading. And each of these have their own specified time, which is like a good or an okay time for the browser to respond in. If that, you know, goes beyond a little bit, beyond that good measure, that's where the problem begins. And again, like I mentioned, it cannot be perfect, but it can be better, right? So for example, for response, if you go into the details of it, the response takes around 100 milliseconds. So if the browser is taking 100 milliseconds to respond to a user input, it's okay. But you lose the user if it goes beyond that. If it becomes 1,000 milliseconds, that's where the user starts getting frustrated. You know, the user starts feeling that, okay, there's a broken interaction, there's a broken experience somehow. If it goes beyond 10,000 milliseconds, for example, which would be what, 10 seconds, right? If the response time takes that long to respond, then maybe there's a problem, right? And then the user will be completely frustrated and might not even come back to the application, might not even decide to do what, you know, maybe it's an opportunity lost for the company if the user is lost at that point. So I think the response time for the browser should really be kept in a range. It can go a little bit above 100 milliseconds, but 100 milliseconds is actually the threshold for it. And actually, there's 50 milliseconds, which is the budget for us to, you know, allow that user interaction, for that input that has, you know, started, that has maybe started an event handler, to take 50 milliseconds, because the rest 50 you want to leave for the browser to respond with. So there's this one response time that the browser takes, and one, the other 50 milliseconds for the input to get processed, you know, so the browser shouldn't take more than 50 milliseconds to process that input, to process that button click or scroll event, or, you know, any click event, hover event, and so on. So yeah, that's only the response part of this Rail guideline. And there's so many other things. Animation, for example, it's about rendering the frame in the browser, and that shouldn't take more than 10 seconds. So you see how specific it is to different, you know, ranges of each step. And that's what makes it a little bit complicated for users to understand. But again, my point is that users shouldn't really have to understand this, right? And it should all be taken care of by the web. And then the I, which is the idle time, that's really important actually for the developer, because as a developer, you should be doing all the work that the user is not waiting for in this idle time, right? This is where you do all the background jobs. This is where you do anything that's not something that the user is waiting for. You give the user the feedback that he was looking for, he or she was looking for, but then any background work is done in this idle time. This is where the browser uses all of its capacity to do all the dev work tasks, maybe the tasks that were supposed to be done later. And yeah, don't do that in the idle time. And then finally, there's this loading time, which is also really important, because this is where the user, the browser finally gives the feedback to the user, you know, whatever the user is waiting for, and then does everything else, you know, like giving the response to the user and also helping and, you know, prioritizing the other tasks in the list of tasks that there are for the browser. So yeah, this is kind of the mechanism to, you know, approach performance, to also think from user's perspective, so to also think from your perspective, like I'm the user and I don't want this button to take more than 10 seconds. If it does, maybe I focus on some other task. But, you know, as a developer, I've lost my user there. Exactly at that point, I've lost my user. So yeah, I think when we, you know, dive deeper into the Rail guidelines, it becomes really important to measure every millisecond, you know? Yeah, I think, and then all of this comes to things like Core Web Vitals, where, you know, there's different metrics to measure performance of the application. There's different metrics to see the maximum time it took for a page to load, the least time it took for first byte to render, and so on.
How does the INP metric differ from the feed metric?
Oh, that's actually a good question. So INP is a new metric. It stands for interaction to next paint. And earlier, this is not a Core Web Vital yet, but the idea is if it, you know, really solves user pains, then the idea would be to make one of the Core Web Vitals. And to your question, which was how it differs from FID, which is an existing Core Web Vital metric, is that FIG always used to load, you know, this first byte, first input delay, right? That's what it stands for, first input delay. So it would only measure the response time of that first input delay, not every interaction. It would wait for that input and then, you know, measure that delay that caused in that input response. That's it. But for interaction to next paint, it measures every interaction. It measures the event handlers. It sees how long it took for that event handler to respond. And that actually is what, as a developer, we would look for, right? Because you're not just looking for the first input. You're looking for the complete interaction experience. You're looking for exactly where the things got slower for the user, right? So interaction to next paint actually helps with that. And you would see that... I think it's 19 applications. This is the data from Web Almanac. It's a, you know, annual report that measures how websites are doing. And according to that annual report, at least one application has 19 long tasks in the, you know, in their application. And that was not the case with FID. So it kind of tells that, okay, we were not measuring exactly what we were supposed to measure. Even in my application, if I would measure the Core Web Vitals, FID seems okay. But I know that my application has many problems that are untimed off. And INP gives a better result. If I would, for example, measure the long task, it would give me definitely more than 19 long tasks. So that's the right measure. And I think making interaction to next paint a Core Web Vital might help if, you know, it helps user pains. Currently, it's very near. We are waiting for, you know, developers to come back with their experience with it, how it's solving problems for them, how slow it is for users, how to measure it, and so on.
How can developers track their website INP value using the Web Vitals library?
Yeah, exactly. So the measuring part, right? This is where the measuring part comes into picture. And to measure their INP, which is the first step and the very important to track their INP, track the slowness of the application of a user, there's this Web Vitals library that allows you to do that. And it offers an onINP method that would give you exactly the number for, you know, how slow a particular task was. You know, everything that we do in the browser is a task, right? Browser separates everything into smaller tasks. And for one thing that you're trying to measure, you would use the Web Vitals library and that method, which is called onINP. It would give you things like name, value, and there's something called attribution. And then you could, you know, maybe log all of those values and see how the result is, or you could send it, you know, to one of your analytics tools that you're using, you know, maybe Datadog or, you know, Full Story or things like that.
What are some ways to optimize INP scores?
Yeah, so this is the next step. In the previous question, we measured INP. right? This is where we know now that, okay, this is the problem. This is this particular, you know, event or this particular implementation that I'm doing is causing the high INP value, right? This is maybe where the problem is. And now I want to optimize that INP score. There's multiple ways to do that. And let's go into the details of, you know, each method. The first way you would do, you know, try to bring down an event, which is a higher INP event and a potential candidate for fixing performance, you would want to bring that down into smaller events, right? Smaller tasks, maybe. Maybe there's one task. Like I mentioned, a browser does everything in tasks. And when one task takes longer than 100 milliseconds, it becomes a long task. So that's the definition of a long task, actually. And when there's too many long tasks that are happening in the implementation of some feature, that's when the INP gets higher, right? And that's what you have to break down. That's the long task that you have to approach and maybe, you know, break it down maybe into smaller tasks or do the approach, do the, you know, the feature that could give the user the right feedback and do everything else in the background. So one way to fix it is using set timeout. Most of you might have sometimes used it to, you know, defer the event, defer the method that you're trying to do to a little later and let the browser do any other things. So that's the way of using set timeout, maybe with a timeout of zero. Doesn't matter how much time you're giving it, but the only reason you're doing set timeout is that it would let the browser know that this method is maybe supposed to be done in a separate task of its own. Not the same long task which was creating that higher INP value. So that's one way, but that's not always ideal because what if you have this loop of events which is trying to solve so many things and it would keep, you know, appending the task to later in the browser and would, you know, not be a perfect situation. To solve that, there's another way of doing this, which is to create like a yield method which would actually implement a promise that only resolves after the task is done in a set timeout event. This still uses set timeout. This still creates a separate task, but because of that promise that you wrap around it, it will be considered a micro task in the browser. And micro tasks take much smaller time than, you know, than an actual task. If you're already a performance geek and if you're already trying out performance, you know, profiling in your application, you would notice there's something called run micro task event in the profiling step. And that run micro task is actually what happens when you, you know, make an event smaller and run it in a micro task instead of running it an actual task, which could take longer again. So that's the second way of doing things, second way of breaking down your task. With this, there could be problems that all the tasks that you defer like this could end up at the end of the queue. And there could also be a situation that the browser never gets to those and then the user feels again broken response. The user might have gone to, you know, scroll down to further in the page, but that's when he receives a feedback for some button that the user clicked earlier in the page. And that could be confusing as an experience, right? To fix those problems, there's something called is input pending. That's an API from Facebook and Chrome, and it's used like navigator.schedule. Is input pending. And the idea of using that is that you only defer a task to later or you only yield to the main thread when you know that the input is actually pending, when you know that user is actually waiting for a response. Only then would you want to tell the browser that, okay, there's some response that you want to respond with and maybe respond with this to the user so that the user doesn't have to wait. And the rest of the things we do later. Right? So this would be completely based on the feedback that the user is waiting or not. You wouldn't want to yield everything to the browser, right? It would also not be a great scenario because you're yielding everything to the main thread and you don't know, or the browser doesn't really know what is important, what is not. So there's something called is input pending, which would help you at least figure out that problem. And ultimately, you would notice at a point, that the browser is confused. What's more important? What should be more prior to solve? You know, what's something that the browser should fix later? What's something that the browser should fix right away? So that crucial priority decision should be made. And to do that, there's this scheduler API that gives you a post-task method. That post-task method allows you to schedule tasks in a certain priority. That priority could be a user visible priority, it could be user blocking, and it could be a default priority. User visible, user blocking, and then the third one is background, right? So user blocking, as the name says, is something really crucial because it's blocking the experience for the user. And that tells the browser that, okay, this is something really important and you want the browser to respond right away with some feedback, with some user input response. With user visible, it's already visible to user. It's the medium priority, so it doesn't really matter. It can be taken care of in the idle time, like the real performance model mentioned, that idle time, right? Which takes care of events which are not priority, not later. And then there's something called background priority, which tells the browser that this can definitely be run in the background whenever the browser has the most time and doesn't need to run it right away. It doesn't need to run it exactly in the idle time, at the start of the idle time. So background completely means that, okay, this is something that the user is not waiting for. And you have complete time for, evaluating this, implementing this, and so on. So that's what Post-Task API allows you to do. And with all of these, the support is not completely out there. But for example, for some of the APIs, Chromium-based browsers support that, but it's not in Safari, for example. Chromium-based browsers support that, but not every browser supports it. And to check that, support, you can always use caniuse.com to, just use the name of the API and check the support for that.
How can you identify long tasks in your application using performance profiling?
Yeah, so this is one really important step to do when you're measuring things. And I've been doing this a lot lately to see how many long tasks are there in my application. So if you go to the Chrome DevTools and go to the performance tab in there, there's this small record icon that you would see on the top left, which tells you that you can now start recording the performance of your application. And when you do that, and actually before that, there would be times when you would notice that the performance seems great for you, but it doesn't work that great for your users. You know the concept of it works on my machine? Always happens with me. So what I try to do, because I have this decently performing M1 machine, but not every user has that, right? Not everyone can have these powerful machines to run your app on. So what I usually do is I throttle the CPU down to reproduce that performance issue. So there's this option of throttling the CPU speed. You could make it 4x slowed down, you could make it 6x slowed down, and then I would, make it maybe 4x slowed down and then record the performance of my application. So click on that recording icon on the top left and then do something on your application that you doubt could be a potential candidate for performance, and then make a small profile, right? Stop it right after doing whatever you were trying to observe, and then it would open this huge, chart kind of a situation for you, which has so many red, yellow things. And it's overwhelming for sure at the beginning, but then with time, you would understand, how it works. And you would see these small triangles, red color triangles, on the top right of each task. Each task is like a rectangle that you would see in the performance panel. It's all obviously better when you actually see it, when you do it yourself. But you would see this little red icon, triangle kind of icon, which tells that this is a long task. And that red triangle is exactly a long task in your application, in your specific frame of events that you're doing. And it would also tell you that this particular task took this long, and that's definitely not ideal. And then it would also, there would be this bottom up tab underneath on the same panel, which would tell you that these are the events that took 20% of that time, that took 80% of that time. And that's exactly where you have to focus. That's exactly where you have to see that, oh, there was some style recalculation that took 80% of the delay time. And that style recalculation, then it would also link you to your code. It would also give you the right link that this is the file and this is exactly in the line in that file which is causing that slowness. It's not always correct because, it has to be really, it cannot be exact about this particular piece of code which is making your thing slow. But you understand the picture from there that, okay, this is maybe it's the search URL, which is causing slowness. Maybe you're loading so many things at the same time. Maybe it's the you know, on Material UI tabs, for example, which are, you know, taking a bit to render, maybe it's the table itself, and so on. So that bottom up tab will actually give you a good idea about what exactly in your code is leading to that, you know, time that you saw in the long tasks. There's also, you would end up getting confused on how to drag and, you know, navigate through that performance panel. It's a trick. It's already written in the browser, but nobody really uses it. There's this keys, WASD. When you open your performance panel and you're into that performance profiler, try using these keys and thank me later. Really, these are the best keys and have really saved me a lot of pain. Again, WASD. They help you navigate left and right on the performance panel. They also let you zoom in and zoom out on the performance panel. So it's really helpful. Should definitely give it a try.
What is the concept of yielding to the main thread and how it can be used to improve a response time?
Yeah, so like we saw how a task, you know, takes too long in the browser when it goes beyond the threshold of 100 milliseconds. And then you want to let the browser know that, okay, maybe there's a smaller task that I want you to deal with first. Let the user know that, you know, okay, this is the feedback, and then do everything else in the background. So to do that, to let the browser know that there's something more important than what you're currently handling, that's exactly what yielding to the main thread means. You let, because there's only this one main thread in the browser, right, which JavaScript runs on. You yield to that main thread, you give it something more important and let it know, let the browser know that, okay, this is the thing that you have to deal with first and everything else later. You know how when something prior comes at work, everyone gets into that bug, everyone gets onto that incident. That's exactly how the browser also has to deal with it. So that's the way of yielding to the main thread. And we already discussed the approaches to do that, which was, remember, we were talking about using set timeout with a zero timeout maybe, or just creating a promise that resolves when the set timeout, you know, actually does its job of running a particular function in a separate task. So yeah, these are the things that would allow you to yield to the main thread. And there's also actually an API, scheduler API, that gives you a yield method. It's not supported on browsers yet, but it's coming in the future. But that yield method will then be a native method. You wouldn't have to write a promise that resolves on the set timeout after the set timeout, but it'll be taken care of by that scheduler.yield API. And yeah, that would really improve performance times in the way that you would make your tasks smaller, you would make, you know, you would lose out, you would, you know, improve that opportunity where you, the browser can really focus on the important tasks and not to, you know, try to deal with everything at the same time. No one is great at multitasking. There are people who are, but, you know, you always mess up when you're trying to do things all at the same time and you have to take things one by one, and you are at your best when you do that. At least with myself, I'm not sure about you.
I definitely prefer to focus on one thing rather than many at once. What kind of person is Nisho and how do you see yourself?
I think just a happy-go-lucky person, if that makes sense. I would just, you know, try to be the most positive person ever. I know it's always not, you know, ideal to be an ice cream which satisfy everybody in terms of, you know, solving pains and all of those. But yeah, I would just try to be that, you know, positive ray of hope where, you know, people around you just feel positive and feel that they can fix problems and nothing is too big of a problem to solve. Yeah, I mean, I remember I was, when I was working with the first company, it was actually IBM. And, you know, there was this trainer who was doing training for everyone. And this is the feedback he actually gave me, that I seem to be this one positive person in the class that makes one, you know, stand up every day and, you know, teach and then show that, okay, there's someone interested and someone who's looking up to you. So yeah, that was a good feedback. And I always, you know, go back to that and think about it.
What do you like to do most in your free time?
So I think there's phases, you know, when there would be one phase when I'm really enjoying reading in my free time, like I mentioned already, that it takes you to another world. But lately, I've been enjoying tennis a lot in my free time. So I go out to play sports. Like I mentioned to you, you know, at the beginning of the conversation as well, that I'm really into tennis and paddle these days. So yeah, that's something that I'm, you know, taking out time for and really enjoying. I also do go to these, there's this colleague at work who, you know, who's into a challenge with myself. We do code wars a lot. So we, you know, send each other these code wars problems and try to fix them and then challenge each other. So it's a good way to do algorithms, you know, apart from work, because things can get boring at a point at work, right? And you do want those, you know, intriguing problems that really make you think, that really make you approach things differently. So we do code wars a lot. It's just like neat code, for example, but a bit more, you know, fun. Yeah, that's what I do as well.
What is your favorite food?
Not sure if you would know this, but there's this Indian dish which is called rajma rice. It's kidney beans, which is the curry, and then rice. I'm not sure if you tried this when you were in India. Yeah, I think we should do that sometime when we are both in India.
As we wrap up this amazing episode, I just want to give a huge thank you to our fantastic guest for joining us today on the JavaScript Master podcast. I'm so grateful that you took time to share the knowledge with us.
Yeah, it was lovely to be here. Thank you very much for, you know, doing this and organizing this.
Thank you so much.